Hello, and welcome to BJGP Interviews. I'm Nada Khan, and I'm one of the associate editors of the BJGP. Thanks for taking the time today to listen to this podcast. In today's episode, we talk to Dr. Zoe Ankers, who is a research fellow based at the Centre for Health and Clinical Research at the University of the West of England. We're talking about the paper she's published here in the BJGP alongside first author Bethan Jones, titled A Qualitative Investigation of the Additional Roles Reimbursement Scheme in Primary Care. So thanks, Zoe, for joining me here to discuss this very topical research paper. I'm sure that most of the people listening will be familiar with the Additional Roles Reimbursement Scheme, or ARRS for short. But for those who aren't, can you tell us a bit about what it is, what ARRS actually means?
Yes. So I think, as we all know, demand in primary care is greater than capacity at the moment, and has been for a while. So one of the solutions to this issue is the Additional Roles Reimbursement Scheme, or as you say, ARRS. We all call it ARRS now because it's quite a mouthful. This scheme was introduced back in 2019, and the aim of the scheme was to recruit 26,000 additional roles into primary care. NHS England reimburse PCNs for salary costs and any on costs for these roles coming in. So at last count, I'm always having to look in case there's a new role again, but sure. I did check before this that at last count, there's 17 roles now in the scheme. And so these can vary from pharmacists to more personalised care roles. Some of the roles are quite well established and have been around quite a while in primary care. So, for example, pharmacists, first contact physiotherapists. But some of the roles are probably still finding their feet, like health and wellbeing coaches. So the aim of the scheme really is to improve and widen access for patients, but also to address the workload pressures that are currently in primary care as a result of the shortages, GP shortages and other staff shortages that are in primary care. Its scheme's also meant to help meet the needs of the local population in the PCNs. And also, finally, and still important, is to provide this advanced career pathway for staff as well.
So quite a complex intervention. And because this is such a new scheme, we didn't really know much about how it worked in practice really before it was rolled out. And your aim here in this study was to look at how ARRS is implemented in practice using this qualitative approach. And who did you speak to here?
Yep. So it was all qualitative study, and we interviewed 37 participants, and they all had some relation to the implementation of the scheme specifically. So it was a range of staff that could be PCN leads, PCN managers, people who are actually responsible for recruiting the staff into PCNs and into practices. We spoke to ICS workforce leads, people who are responsible for workforce development. And then, of course, we included the ARRS role staff themselves. So a number of them. So I think we had some wellbeing people in there. We had physios, we had pharmacists, social prescribers as well. So hopefully a big range that could give us the depth of the experience about the impact of the scheme.
Yeah, so people who are really in the know here. And your results focused on the things that enabled the success of the scheme and then some of the challenges of the scheme as well. I just want to start touching upon some of the results from your interviews with these different stakeholders. First of all, how did the availability of the different roles and how they were used vary between the different practices? Because this isn't something that's implemented in one way that fits all, really.
No, and there was definitely variation, and probably one of our key findings, which was a barrier, which was called what we called was scheme inflexibility. And this really did show the variation of the scheme. So this category in our data describes the inflexibilities that are in the schemes, and it revealed, unfortunately, that those PCNs who were in areas of more deprivation were not able to make effective use of the scheme as perhaps more wealthier PCNs or those in low deprivation. So inflexibilities around the scheme included unanticipated additional costs for recruiting and retaining staff. So, for example, supervision cover costs, that's not covered by the scheme. Engagement of these third parties to actually recruit. Again, those wealthier PCNs could afford those costs, but those in lower deprivation couldn't. And some of those health inequality areas were really coming through. So we definitely had something called population deprivation, where we found that staff recruitment is more challenging in areas of high deprivation. The same is for GPs. It's not a new concept, but we also found it for these additional roles. So that was concerning as well.
And you've touched upon this, but one of the challenges of the scheme has been the lack of built-in mentorship or training. And you also said that you talked to people here who manage the training hubs. But what did you find here about the use of training hubs and whether that was a useful addition to the scheme?
That definitely came in our list of success factors and an enabler of the scheme. This scheme, along came the scheme with what we call the R's roadmaps. They came late. When they did come, they were overwhelming to staff. We heard that they took a great deal of time of investment. And I think I'm directly quoting this. They were seen as this necessary evil that staff had to get through to get to be one of the roles. The training hubs in all the three areas where we interviewed were crucial for helping demystify these roadmaps and all the training guidance that went along it. So the training hubs are specialized. So if you're a pharmacist, you go to the training hub that helps you with the pharmacist roadmaps, because, of course, there's a different roadmap for every role. It's very difficult for one hub to get around all those roadmaps. They were extremely successful. We heard that from staff. And on top of that, I think they also really helped advocate for the scheme in general across PCNs. So really helping PCN managers see the benefit of these roles.
So that was definitely one of the success areas. But there has been some concern about whether ours is actually saving GP time in practice. What did your respondents feel their input was about the impact on GP workload and whether they were helping in this way?
Yeah, this was probably a key finding for our study, I think. So we heard that staff were definitely feeling welcome. They were feeling valued. Some told us that they felt like they were making a difference. There was lots of examples with pharmacists, for example, that they felt like they were relieving some burden. But in general, across the board, we discovered in the data that the success of the roles isn't perhaps reducing burden on GPs as yet. It's a bit too soon. The success was the care is being provided is more broad. We're able to provide that this extra skill mix can increase access to specialist care and appointments. It's also linked to supervision as well. And that was one of our challenges, is that GPs are also expected to, in many of these roles, fulfill a supervisory role, which is already adding to their current workload.
Yeah, and which is unpaid or not accounted for currently in ours.
Yeah, not. It wasn't anticipated almost by the scheme about time that would be required for that, and the finance wasn't there.
Finally, as a complex intervention, there was some discussion of the wider impacts of the scheme within the NHS on issues like workforce. What did you find here, and what did the people that you talked to describe about these sort of wider system impacts?
Yeah, we can probably group these in our unintended consequences of the scheme and these wider impacts. So there were two. The first one was the impact on the secondary care systems. So we very much heard that staff are leaving secondary care. And the examples that we heard about were ambulance trusts and mental health organisations. And they're coming to work in these R schemes because they're very attracted to the work-life balance that the roles provide for them in R's. No more shift work, which is why they're leaving those secondary care systems, but also because the variety that the role might provide them. We heard it from pharmacists in secondary care as well. So that is happening, and that is a concern. There were solutions proposed in the interviews about rotational positions that people are trying out and secondments to try and to stop this occurring, and obviously impeding on these, you know, depleting these secondary care systems from an experienced staff essentially moving into ours. So that was the one unintended consequence. The other one was the impact on existing primary care staff, so the non-R staff in primary care. And we heard from them, and this wasn't all, but we definitely heard from some that existing staff reflected that the R staff have better terms, better conditions, better pay than themselves. And we also heard that it's important to avoid de-skilling any of the staff. I think it came up with nurse practitioners that they sometimes felt like they some of their skills were sidelined with this extra skill mix coming into primary care.
There's been a bit of a push recently for other roles to be added to R's, for instance, practice nurses, and some GPs are saying that they should be added to R's because there's a concern that some PCNs are hiring people within the R's scheme roles at the expense of other roles. Did anyone that you spoke to mention this area?
This did not come up at all in our interviews, but I've definitely been following it and seeing the interest in this petition growing and the number of signatures growing for these two types of staff. It's quite a surprise. And I think it would have come up as a surprise for our participants because this scheme was introduced because there weren't enough GPs, which was one of the key reasons for bringing in these additional roles. So all I can say on that, it's definitely an interesting discussion moving forward, but we did not hear absolutely any detail about that at all. I should say we didn't include GPs in our sample. We know that there was a large study being completed at the same time, which was collecting GPs' views about the roles. So we didn't have the GP voice and we didn't have the patient voice in our sample.
And any other key findings you'd like to highlight coming out of this research?
I think what we found was quite similar to what was initially found, but our key finding was about the scheme inflexibility. But the other two categories probably just worth mentioning, although they've been found before, but career progression was probably another one that is worth highlighting because we know it's important to ensure this sustainable pipeline of these professionals into the scheme to make it continue and for it to be effective. But we did learn that lots of staff, as soon as they completed their training pathway, were leaving. And we learned that because they were leaving because there weren't these career progression opportunities for them. The other one, and this has been a consistent one as well, but I think it's important not just to mention it because we're finding it still, was infrastructure and integration. So both estates, people didn't have office space. They didn't have clinical equipment. That was really lacking. People were doing their best. They described situations to me where they would be in a back cupboard if they did. So they're really trying to make the most of it and do their best. But it was a real problem for people. Another problem was about the integration. So obviously in PCNs, you're working across multiple practices. Staff really struggled with that because they felt like they could at times feel isolated. They didn't really know where they belonged or got to know other staff. We did hear instances from personalised care workers where a hub had been set up for similar roles like health and wellbeing coaches, our mental health practitioners, anything in personalised care really, where they all worked in the same hub, which solved some of the infrastructure problems. And also they were integrated and working with staff dealing with similar patients. So if that's viable, that would be a good way to address those issues.
Really interesting. And I think there's lots of things that you've mentioned here about things that people can take away from your research about how to better integrate these roles into practice, about training and about career progression as well to support them. Do you have any key take-home messages for those working in primary care or for people who are commissioning these roles in the future? Because as we know, the R's scheme has been extended now. So there's almost a chance to improve the way it's being rolled out across England.
Definitely. I may have already alluded to a lot of the recommendations as I was talking about the findings. But yeah, to build the sustainable workforce, there definitely need to be more career progression opportunities and looking at each role individually. Also thinking about that rotational working to avoid impeding our overworked secondary systems. There needs to be more clarity around these roadmaps. And I think some work has probably been done since we've collected the data, but also perhaps recognizing any accreditation of learning. We heard about some staff who have to complete these roadmaps, yet they've already got some qualification or experience where they don't need to redo it. So perhaps recognizing that would make people more efficiently complete the roadmaps. Keep those professional leads in the training hubs to help guide them through those roadmaps that hopefully are being updated. Supervision, I know we mentioned that earlier, it's definitely suboptimal. It was when we collected the data for staff, and we know the reasons why. So one suggestion was that perhaps follow more university training pathways that can provide supervision instead of having to rely on the practice-based supervision to consider that. But probably the key one for us is to come back to the flexibility around the funding in the scheme. So regarding who is funded, what is funded, but you know, our key recommendation would be that it's just important to provide this more funding flexibility to prevent any further widening of these health inequalities in the scheme in primary care.
No, thanks for that. And I think that this research has been really important to highlight some of the successes and barriers in a scheme as new as ours, in a scheme that it's a complex intervention in a very complex system. So it's really important to start to understand how things are impacting people in practice. So yeah, I just wanted to say thank you very much for your time and for speaking to us here today.
Well, many thanks for the invitation and for the opportunity to talk about the study.
And thank you all very much for your time here and for listening to this BJGP podcast. Zoe's original research article can be found on bjgp.org, and the show notes and podcast audio can be found at bjgplife.com. It's been great to have a chat with Zoe about this very topical issue given the recent renewal of the RS scheme, and I hope you've all enjoyed our chat today. Thanks again for listening, and bye!